Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
Revolution was not a game, and revolution was not just to be taken lightly. The revolution is serious business. So I'm very clear, when people start talking about we're just going to have a revolution in the streets, you might want to think about exactly what that means, right?
Yeah. The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 206, a talk with Nana Ashhurst. Nana, formerly Carmen, played a key role in the history of hip-hop's most iconic label, Def Jam, and in the career of its co-founder, Russell Simmons. Of course, before that, she met Malcolm X through her activist parents and helped to run a revolution in Grenada. No big deal. She joined Def Jam in the 1980s as an assistant, but quickly worked her way up to president. While there, she also oversaw Russell's expansion into fashion, movies, and comedy with properties like the fashion label Fat Farm and the TV show Def Comedy Jam. Nana oversaw Def Jam in the early 1990s, right as gangsta rap was beginning to take over the industry, and she has some valuable insights into how and why that happened. She also, as you'll hear, has a fascinating political background and family history that informed her work in hip-hop. We talked to Nana Ashhurst at Crosstown Studios in Harlem. If you like the show, please check out our Patreon at patreon.com/thecyphershow. It helps us keep the pets fed, and we've recently updated our rewards with some crazy new stuff. If you want to know any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list and the show notes. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what's going on with The Cipher. And now, here's the woman who turned Def Jam into a powerhouse, Nana Ashhurst. Nana, I wanted to start by taking it back to the beginning. And actually kind of a generation before you. Your father was very political and very involved in the world. Stepfather. Can you tell me a little bit about him?
Sure. It's funny. He's actually 94 right now and is home on hospice care. So his life is coming to an end, but he was what we now call a public intellectual. Right? Mm-hmm. His name was Keith E. Baird. And he came to this country from Barbados. He was a very well-educated person, but when he first got here as an immigrant, he ended up having to work in hospitals, emptying bedpans and so on. He continued to do a lot of work. He did. My father was a union organizer. My stepfather was a public intellectual. Oh. When I was growing up, he spoke 14 languages. By now, he speaks 21. We had over 10,000 books in our home. But more than that, because he knew all these languages, when African countries were becoming free at that time, in order to join the UN, you have to submit your, I guess, constitution or whatever, in the five languages, in the several languages of the United Nations. I'm not even sure if it's five, but you know, French, English, Spanish, whatever.
Sure.
And so finding a black person who could do that level of translating, because it's becomes pretty technical and whatnot. So anyway, he got to become very engaged in Pan-Africanist movement and engaged us in the Pan-African movement. He and his friends, two friends, Richard B. Moore and John Clark, started doing work around the word Negro, and eventually decided that the name Negro was an evil name, right? And that it was its origins and evil uses were about defining people by their color, us, by our color, mm-hmm. rather than by our culture. So they decided, they proposed that we should start calling ourselves African Americans rather than black. And they were the ones who actually talked to Malcolm X, and he adapted that language because of him.
For his organization.
Yes. Yeah. In fact, my stepfather is one of the founders of his organization.
Malcolm X.
Malcolm X's Post Nation of Islam organization, co-founded in 1964 by Nana's stepfather and John Henrik Clark, was the Organization of Afro-American Unity.
My stepfather was a pallbearer at his funeral. Right. So we were very close to there. But I was 12.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Do you have childhood memories of Malcolm?
Sure. On my sofa. Coming down the stairs, and I had rollers in my hair, and I was horrified that that's what he was seeing. But I actually would speak with him at rallies. We went to his, he spoke at the Armory, 163rd Street Armory, maybe once a month, and we went to those. And my mother would be very, she wanted to go because she loved Malcolm, but did not like that women and men were separated. So my mother was a person who actually, before the women's movement became a big thing, she was pushing those issues to my stepfather, who, as a West Indian, was pretty much a patriarch. And so just trying to get him to understand that she had rights as a woman beyond just being a black woman was a struggle that they had. And in fact, it had played a role in them actually breaking up. Right? So that even within my household, the issues of what were, there was a social issue conversation all the time. But they would, my mother also spoke seven languages. So they would speak in different languages on the table if they didn't want me to understand what they were talking about. For me, it was an interesting way to get into political work. So I was on picket lines at age 14 when the New York City public schools had had a strike.
We shall not be moved.
The NYC teacher strike Nana mentions here lasted from May to November of 1968, shutting down public schools for a total of 36 days.
And during that time, the teachers who were striking set up freedom schools elsewhere so that when you got took off the day from school, you didn't just get to stay home. You had to do this. And my parents all both taught in a freedom school, and I was leading a picket line. I was a picket line captain. So from a very early age, I became involved with the movement.
Were you or your stepfather, your mother, at the speech where Malcolm was shot?
No.
On February 21st, 1965, Malcolm was preparing to address a meeting of the Organization of Afro-American Unity at the Audubon Ballroom in Washington Heights when he was shot and killed.
No, mm-hmm. No. Both my parents did go to the March on Washington. Mm-hmm. They did not take me because they were afraid of potential violence. And then I would go to see Malcolm all the time, and that's when something happened.
Right.
But I didn't happen to be there that that day.
Mm-hmm. Where in Brooklyn did you grow up?
What is now Lefferts Gardens, right between Crown Heights and Flatbush, right? Mm-hmm. Sterling Street.
Oh, okay.
My early age, actually, at my earlier time was in what is now Fort Greene. I was first moved on Cambridge Place, and then, as a matter of fact, I lived around the corner from Biggie.
Oh.
Right? Biggie's mom, right? He wasn't, Biggie didn't exist yet, right? But, yeah, we looked literally one block over. Right?
Oh, wow.
So that neighborhood has a lot of history going on in it as well. But political history, even before Biggie, there was several other families who were engaged in movement work who were all, we all lived on one block. And then we were actually, our friendships were pretty much contained by our parents. We had to be selective about who we could engage with.
Mm-hmm.
And so even though I have two stepsisters, but I don't have any blood siblings, but I grew up so closely with the children of other movement people that they, in fact, have become my siblings. And in fact, my son and I have Christmas with them every year, and that's our family, right?
How did you end up at BU for your master's?
Who gave you all this? Well, I went to undergraduate school in the Midwest, and that was horrible. And so I wanted to be a journalist. I wanted to be engaged with what was going on, civil rights, civics, you know, and so on. But I also loved television. I was just a child of my time. And so the way I figured I could combine it was to do broadcast journalism. So I went to BU to get a master's in broadcast journalism. And I ended up staying in Boston for 9 years. I went to work for a local television station there, worked for a program called Third World. And then from there, went and started doing independent films with a company called Blackside that was run by Henry Hampton. They're best known for Eyes on the Prize, though I was not on that particular project.
Eyes on the Prize is the Academy Award-nominated 14-part documentary about the U.S. civil rights movement. It was put out in two parts, the first in 1987 and the second in 1990.
Once I started doing that, I went into independent film for several years.
Wow. Bill happened to mention that you were friends with Mackie McLeod and his wife. So for people who wouldn't know, and I didn't know until he mentioned it, who was Mackie?
Well, how does he describe Mackie? Mackie McLeod was a radio journalist who did a lot of work in Boston, and then subsequently went international and did a lot of work stories in Zambia and in South Africa. Mm-hmm. He was a person who really understood that radio had a capacity to travel even further than television in many ways at that time. Television wasn't quite as embedded in every single household right. as it has become, but radio was, and it's in your car and it's everywhere. And so he was really a force in making radio do documentary work and not just music.
At a certain point, you end up in Grenada working, putting together films, television for them.
I originally went to Grenada as an independent journalist working for Freedom Ways magazine, which no longer exists, but was a Black Thought leadership magazine of the 60s and 70s. And John Henry Clark was the editor. So I went with credentials for that. And I went to the first anniversary of the revolution. Had no idea that it was going to be as amazing as it was. Saw Morris Bishop and just saw a whole government that was determined to turn from neocolonialism to making this government focus on the needs of the people.
The People's Revolutionary Government of Grenada, headed by Morris Bishop, took power in March 1979 after a revolution. Beset by internal conflicts, which you'll hear about in a minute, and facing a U.S. military intervention, the government collapsed in the fall of 1983. Babylon fall, not the dreadlocks are free of a country. One a man done, not the dread in a PRA.
When the needs were stark, because only 14% of the country at the time was fully literate, which is unusual. Barbados, on the other hand, which is a nearby island, the education was, a literacy rate was like 80-something percent. Mm-hmm. So the British really had just felt that this was an island to just get sugar and cocoa out of rather than doing anything for the people. All of the roads were designed specifically to get product from wherever they were to the port. They had nothing to do with where people lived. And all of the food was imported, even though this was a place where they grew food and was, you know, an island surrounded by water with the fish, right? It's not like you have to import, but they do import.
Unfortunately, a very common colonial model.
Yes. Yeah. And so I saw these people who were doing this, but they were, first of all, they were Black. Right. So it was no longer like just thinking that you had to deal with the Soviet sphere, which was the thing thought at the time. You no longer had to think that only Cuba was going to be here because, you know, since I didn't speak Spanish, that was not going to be a place where I could be comfortable. So Grenada was Black, spoke English, had great music, right, and was committed to the development of its own people. And that was such a distinct difference from every other country that was at that time trying to become independent. Mm-hmm. And I was just, I loved it. And so I came back to this country. I left Boston and moved to New York and just started writing over and over and over again until they let me go. In fact, when I came back here, I worked for Betty Shabazz. I was her publicist. That was my side, my little job, my part-time job.
Betty Shabazz was an educator and civil rights activist who was the wife of Malcolm X. She died in 1997.
She was at Medgar Evers at the time, mm-hmm. teaching. And so from there, I wrote and wrote. And then the Grenadian government hired a man named Samori Marksman to put together a team of people to help them establish a national television station and radio station. And he hired me and two other people to do the television station. Elaine Bally was the person who was the liaison between the station and the government. And then Michael Frenchman was the technical person, and I was the production person. And so on election day of 1980, I voted on my way to the airport. And when I landed in the airport, I found out that Ronald Reagan had won. Right? And I was real glad to be in Grenada at the time.
I can imagine.
I hadn't voted for him. Right. Right?
Right. We'll keep that between us. That's fine. Yeah.
So, and the television station there, there was a television station, but it was in fact a room, right, with a, you know, small camera. And it primarily did things like repeat programming of Trinidad's Carnival, lots of stuff that came down from satellites. So a lot of it was religious programming that was up on the satellites for free. That's what you could get down. And then the local programming was pretty much maybe two talk shows on a Sunday, but that was it. So all of the programming was primarily came from the United States. So I was watching Julia.
Make yourself as handsome as you can manage. I'm tired of looking at ugly nurses. I married one.
I'll do my best, sir. But has Mr. Colton told you?
Tell me what?
I'm colored.
What color are you?
I'm a Negro.
You always been a Negro, or you're just trying to be fashionable?
Julia was a sitcom starring Diane Carroll as a widowed single mother who worked as a nurse. It ran from 1968 to 1971.
And all these other very old TV shows that were even old then, right, in the 80s. But because they were made in America and because they had very, very high production value, which we take for granted, but in other places they do not. And so the comparison between the programs that were being produced locally and the programs that they were seeing was making people want to see more American programming rather than producing their own. So the task was to make the shows, the programming, be competitive in production value to what they were seeing. Right. And that was my job. And so I had about 35 people, and I trained them in television production and writing. We produced the first four local programs that were based upon what the people were actually doing. The station was owned half by the government and half by the person from whom they bought the station. But we never saw him. We were really working for the government. Yeah. And my job became to document what was the day-to-day running of a revolution, right? And I was like, how do you find a job like this? It was just extraordinary. And I learned it from hands-on, that how you build a revolution, it's not necessarily how we just think of revolutions as you go out in the jungle and you come out with a gun and you shoot it up and win. Once you get the government, you have to run the government. You have to govern. And so things that I did not think, that I thought were crazy, example, the very first thing, there was only $41 in the bank account when the government took over, right? And so they had to get money fast, right?
Right.
So parking tickets, right? Right. They started collecting the money from parking tickets.
Right.
Would I think the parking tickets was a revolutionary act? No, but it is in that context, right? Because how do you keep the government going? And then in order to get people to be able to understand a constitution that they had decided, they needed to write a new constitution, but it was going to be a several years process. But people needed to know how to read in order to be able to participate in the discussion. So the year before I got there, between 79 and 80, they had initiated a campaign for a literacy campaign. Right? And when I got there, it was in full swing, and you saw both adults and young people who had finished school being taught how to read. And all of the books that we were using for that adult literacy had been written. So they were talked about Caribbean culture, Caribbean geography, rather than the British stuff that had been used before. Wow. It was just remarkable. By the time I left in 83, the literacy level had already gone up to over 70%. And within another year, the year after, it went up even higher. This meant that people, every single town, and these towns were like really small. Grenada is only 22 miles long, 13 miles wide. So it's a small country. So, but each little community considers itself a real town. And the leaders of the government, Morris Bishop himself, Bernard Cord himself, all of these people would go out to meetings literally every single night and explain to the people what it was they were trying to do, get immediate feedback. And because people knew these people since they were children, and it's, they felt very comfortable, like yelling at them, telling them what they really
wanted. Telling the president what was really on their minds.
Yes, right. Yeah. Because, nobody called him Mr. Prime Minister. Everybody called him Morris, right? Wow. And he had bodyguards, but he was very free with them. I mean, he didn't always have them. I remember seeing Morris standing near a window at a celebration, dancing with his back to an open window. And I thought then, you know, like, that would never happen for a president in any, you know, in the United States. You just couldn't do that. So there was a level of a sense of freedom that was so pervasive that you didn't even notice all the different ways you were free until I came back to the United States, right? And I got off the plane and I saw people, that, you know, every cop has a gun, everyone, right? You know, they're everywhere, you know, and if you haven't seen a gun in a while, you do notice them more, right? Or sure. I did, right? So it was a remarkable experience to me to be engaged with an actual revolution. There was a militia, you know, we had to learn what to do in case of an invasion, which turned out to be
actually
right. Turned out to be a useful thing to know.
Right.
The island of Grenada, which is a tiny island, as you know, in the southern Caribbean, it has been invaded by a multinational force, as it's being described. The bulk of that force, about 1,800 American troops, that includes Marines and apparently airborne troops as well, and about 300 troops from some islands around Grenada. They were sent there by President Reagan from Barbados early this morning, he says, at the request of the Organization of Eastern Caribbean States. Those are the island nations around Grenada. Grenada is an island country that is now in the control of a Marxist military council after its Marxist prime minister was executed in a military coup just last week.
There was an expat community a bit, but I was part of the internationalist workers, and there were about 60 internationalist workers from the United States. We came from all parts of the country. We did not come together. We just found ourselves there in various projects. But we had to be, we were more than the other internationalist workers. We had to be very cautious because we knew, everybody knew, that the CIA was there somewhere, right? Mm-hmm. And it wasn't me, but right. You know, but there was no reason,
I mean,
for other people.
No way
to,
of knowing that,
right,
probably.
Right.
Yeah.
And so we were a more cautious in behavior kind mm-hmm. of group. But it's a very comforting, comfortable country, very laid back. I don't know if you've ever heard the phrase to lime.
No.
But okay, to lime is something that it's a Caribbean phrase, and it's the sort of like hanging out, but it's a little more than that. You leave the house, right, and you just have no idea where you're going. You stop by a rum shop. You hang out there, have a little sardines and some rum with somebody and some beer. And then you guys say, well, what are we going to do? Do you know so-and-so up the road? And then you just drive off to do that, and you go there. And then from there, you might end up at the beach. And you just spend the day with no plan, right? Mm-hmm. What is critical to liming, though, is witty conversation and political conversation. Right? Both of those things were constant in Grenada. And no matter how old you were, right, you know, young kid, well, maybe if you were kindergarten, maybe you wouldn't be, but certainly elementary school age children on up all had political discussions all the time, right? And were very clear on what was happening in the country. Even the quote-unquote bourgeois class, which was significant in Grenada, lots of, you know, insurance salesmen and cars and so on. They were, you know, hesitant about a progressive, a Marxist government, like mm-hmm. as the People's Revolutionary Government was. But this government did not nationalize. They bought and shared whatever mm-hmm. properties they took over.
Not long after you get home from this job, mm-hmm. Morris is killed.
Well, I came home and started working on a film, a documentary that was supposed to be aired for the fifth anniversary of the revolution, which would have been 1984. Mm-hmm. So, and this was 1983, and myself, John Douglas, and Samori, the guy who had hired me in the first place, started making this film, which is called Grenada, the Future Coming Towards Us. Mm-hmm. And it was a film that documented exactly why there was the revolution and what were the different achievements.
This revolution is creating a new democracy. It has opened up great opportunities for the people to participate in making the decisions which affect their everyday lives and the future of their country.
Just as we were getting ready to show the film, the rough cut, to Unison Whiteman, who was the government officer who was coming up to the United Nations. And while he was here, we were going to show him the film. And then he tells us, oh, I know I'm supposed to come see the film, but I can't because there's an emergency back home. And so he went home And then he was arrested along with Morris Bishop. And 4 days later, they were both executed along with 7 other people. And then a week after that, the United States invaded Grenada. And Grenada became an occupied country by the United States for about 5 years. And now it's just back to being a plain old neocolonial country.
What was it like for you to go through hearing about that while you were home?
It was disgusting. I was home and somebody called me at 4 a.m. to tell me they had heard a story that Morris had been shot. And that seemed impossible. Morris was killed. The faction that had taken over the government within the party was led by Bernard Cord, who had been his minister of finance. So when I had to do budgets for the television station, I had to present them to Bernard. It was he who I negotiated my contract with and so on. On a day-to-day basis, Morris was the minister of information as well as the prime minister. And so he was my boss, the person who dealt with what we could and couldn't put on the air and what kinds of programming they wanted to see. So the idea that one person who I knew and respected had killed another person who I cared about and respected was just beyond my understanding. And it definitely made it clear that revolution was not a game and revolution was not just to be taken lightly. The revolution is serious business. So I'm very clear when people start talking about we're just going to have a revolution in the streets, you might want to think about exactly what that means, right?
You know, you do some other stuff. You're involved with Film Fund and mm-hmm. some other things. At a certain point, you call up your old Boston friend, Bill Adler, mm-hmm. and you say, hey, I hear you've got this job. Can I work with you?
I didn't even know he had a job.
Oh.
Right. I worked for the Film Fund, and we did an event, a big event, a tribute to Harry Belafonte. Mm-hmm. At the Ziegfeld Theater, which got sold out. It was amazing. Bill Cosby was the MC. Sidney Poitier came, Denise Nicholas, Rosa Parks, the ambassador from South Africa. It was just extraordinary. And from that experience, I discovered I really enjoyed production. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed music production. I enjoyed working with artists. And so I wanted to get into the music business. So I just started calling every single person I knew who had anything to do with with entertainment. And Bill was one of those people. And that was pretty, I mean, that I knew Bill as a writer, right?
Sure.
From the Boston Herald and a music writer, but he was also a social critic. Right? I did not know that he was with Def Jam. He was actually with Rush Artist Management, and I didn't know what that was. I knew, you know, a bit about rap, you know, but I knew it from like Beat Street, you know, right? I didn't, you know, The Jungle. I had heard that, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Rapper's Delight. I was not deeply into the culture. So when I had no idea what Bill was really doing until I met with him. And then he told me that he had a part-time job, a short-term job over the summer to be an assistant publicist on the Runs House tour that was going on a 70-city tour. We were on the road with Run DMC with the headliners, Public Enemy, Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, and then the fourth act would change by city. So sometimes it was Stetsasonic, sometimes it was JJ Fad, twice it was NWA, right, which created quite a show. And my job was the Runs House, Run DMC had created, had an agreement with the NAACP to do a voter registration drive throughout the thing. So we were doing voter registration campaigns at every city. The NAACP from that city did the actual signing up, but we did a press conference at every city mm-hmm. so that people would know. And then when the kids came to the shows, and this was stadiums, you know, as well as smaller, but mostly large arenas. It was wonderful and important to see the guys, Run DMC, having that level of engagement. That was also the same year that Jesse Jackson was running for president.
I was going to say, wasn't there an event you did for him?
Yes. Right. Yeah. That was actually the very first thing I ever did when I got there was when Bill, Jesus, Bill said to me, when the artists make a record, you have to submit their lyrics, all right, to ASCAP BMI, right? Mm-hmm. And even though the artists have lyrics, sometimes it changes what they wrote to what ends up on the record. So my job was to transcribe Slick Rick's album, and my very first song was "Treat Her Like a Prostitute." Right?
As Rick is my name, I wouldn't trust no girl unless she feels the same. Treat him like a prostitute. Do what? Don't treat no girlie well until you're sure of the scoop.
And I was like, boy, maybe I don't know how I got here. That was the very first. And I was like, you know, I could tell you all the words, but I won't. But that was when I felt like, this is different from Grenada. This right. is really different from Grenada. It was several weeks before I actually met Russell in person. I knew him as a voice over the phone. Mm-hmm. But so when I first got there, Slick Rick was headlining a show at the Apollo for Jesse Jackson. Right. So my job became to put it together to make sure that everybody got there. So I did. And both Lior and Russell were surprised. Lior Cohen, who was, everybody knows who Lior is. Okay. Yes.
Lior Cohen began his time in Russell Simmons' orbit in 1984 as the road manager for Run DMC. Within a few years, he was signing artists like Slick Rick and A Tribe Called Quest to Rush Artist Management and was leading the company by 1989. That same year, he moved over to the record label side of the business with the formation of Rush Associated Labels. Lior is now the global head of music at YouTube.
And Russell Simmons were surprised that this person who had just come on in April could produce a show for them in May. So they wanted to know who it was. Right? Mm-hmm. So we were in a room, a bunch of us, Bill Adler, Lior, Lisa Cortez, Heidi Smith.
Lisa's a good friend of the show.
Right? A bunch of us. And this voice from the phone, right, with Russell asking what was going on, how did it work out? And then he said, well, how did that happen so quickly? And Bill gave me the credit for that. And then Russell says to him, to Bill, you know, so are you sticking her yet? That was my introduction to Russell.
beginning of a years long friendship.
Right. And so that at first I was like, I might have landed in the wrong place. Right. You know, when we were back, we were still in the city.
Yeah.
But the music just amazed me. And along at the same time, I mean, Lisa Cortez was there. Lisa is no joke. Right?
Of course, yeah.
Bill Stefani was there. Bill Stefani was no joke. Right? So there were a number of other people who were there that led me to believe that something else was going on than just this, you know, juvenile thing. I'll just leave it at that. Was going on that made me decide to stay. But I thought of, you know, Bill as this serious journalist who wrote for the Boston Herald, which was the number two newspaper in Boston. Right?
Yeah.
So now he was writing for, you know, kid magazines. You know, I don't even remember the teen so-and-so, you know, girls. Mm-hmm. I don't even remember the names, but they were, you know, aimed at teen audiences. Right. And I was like, this isn't real journalism, is it? Except I did not realize at the time, but Bill was actually writing the history of the music as we went along.
It was happening, yeah.
That's exactly what was going on. So it was, in that regard, it was similar to me in my head with what I was doing in Grenada, that this was a movement that was happening and we were getting to document it as it went along. I didn't quite understand the historical significance for maybe another year or two.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I think you've pointed out about Russell and his vision even back then, was he was maybe the first person with the power to do anything about it to really see, okay, with hip hop, let's not worry about whether kids like the music so much. Let's sell it as rebellion, as a lifestyle, and that will be easy, you know, it'll be easier to kind of cross over and sort of worry about
the other way around
later. It was the other way around.
Yeah, he believed that, you're correct. He saw very early on rap and hip hop, right, as a culture rather than just the music. He saw the music and how it fit in with a variety of other things, dance, language, clothing, and so on. But he was never interested in crossing over. He wanted the white audience to cross over to us. That was a distinction, a serious distinction between Russell and Berry Gordy.
Gordy, of course, founded Motown Records in 1959.
Russell was not interested in having his artists dress up to be comfortable for white kids, right? He wanted white kids to start wearing clothes like black kids did. Believed that white kids have always followed black kids in fashion, but we just hadn't taken advantage of it. He felt that the spirit of rock and roll was the same spirit that was happening in basketball courts around every black community in the country, right? Mm-hmm. The community that Russell had in his head, and he still uses it to this day, right, was, I want to make sure that the people in Boise, Idaho, hear this music and love it and want to come to it, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not sure he ever even saw Boise, Idaho. It was just the name of it, you know, right. Boise, Idaho was just so white, you know, that you could just imagine, you know, right. like what it was. And if that community could love this music, that's when he knew he was right. Right. At the same time, you know, like the radio stations weren't letting our music on. We were not letting hip hop on the radio. Certainly not during the day. They might let it be on the, you know, the nighttime shows. Soul Train would not let us on. Arsenio Hall, who was the night show at that time, would not let our acts on. I mean, it was the black community was not. Or the black proper community, right, was not comfortable with the images that they were coming out of these and the lyrics that were coming out. Now, this was before gangster rap, mind you. This is right. Early when the music was pretty much a lot of party music. I mean, Public Enemy, of course, and African Bambaataa, but they were amongst many, right? There was as much party music as there was any social commentary, and people were still scared of it. Right? Right. So for Russell, that was like, oh, we need to break this. And for me, it was like, wow, this is like, this is a black music. We're coming from a company that is at least, it's not necessarily black owned because Rick Rubin was there and then at first, so it was a half black owned company, mm-hmm. but it was black led, right?
Yeah.
And the white people in the company were willing and happy to follow black leadership, right? And that is very different in the music business. I do not think that hip hop would have developed this way, the way it has, had it started with, you know, Warner Brothers, the main record labels. Right. It had to start in independent labels.
Yeah. I want to get kind of a visual picture of, you know, you mentioned the Runs House tour, and that was mm-hmm. obviously such a, in retrospect, kind of a historic tour.
Yes.
And it was your job to kind of settle up at the end of the night, right?
No, my job was to, well, I was deal with them on the PR thing, set up the press conferences that mm-hmm. started everything. But I shared the room with the guy who was the financial guy, right?
Okay,
Jake, right? And he was a clear rocker, you know, with, you know, stuff hanging in his hair and torn jeans. He was white, you know, and he would come in at the end of every show to, like, reconcile the gate and so on and pay the artists as well as the promoters, right? Mm-hmm. But through that, sitting with him every night for 7 weeks, right, I really ended up learning an awful lot about how the touring business worked and how that fit with the record company, what our marketing plans were, what marketing plans were, and I was able to carry that back with me when I went back to working with, you know, in the office.
And so you and Russell obviously work very closely together, which in some ways is strange because especially back then with the Russell Simmons of the 80s, as opposed mm-hmm. to kind of the more buttoned-down, yoga-doing businessman we think of now, you guys would seem to be complete opposites.
Yeah, I actually think it helps that I was older than he. Mm-hmm. Right. I was therefore not attractive. Right. To put it kind of bluntly, right. I wasn't on his radar as, you know, like you know, a woman in that regard. Right. Mm-hmm. In fact, the way I started working with him is I came back after the tour and while on the tour, the people at Motown had also gotten to know me and know my work. And so they offered me a job. Right? So when I came back, I asked Russell, would he please help me negotiate this job with them? And he said, well, why? And I said, well, this job is the job for you is ending. I think at this time I had seen Russell. I saw Russell on the road a lot, but, you know, it's not like we hung out and sat down to talk about it. So this was, you know, like one of the first conversations that he had and I had that was specifically about my career with him. Right. And so he said, well, why are you leaving? And I said, well, I got this job offer and the job is over. Can you help me? And he said, no, I want you to stay with me. I'm going to make you my personal assistant. So, you know, Bill Adler was pissed. He was like,
finally had some help and then it gets taken away.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But then Russell was not coming into the office. He was staying in his apartment. He was living on Barrow Street at the time. And he would not come into the office. And so for, I would say, maybe a month, I was sitting at my, I stayed at my same desk. I was sitting across from Bill. I was no longer doing Bill's work. I was just sort of picking up whatever came by. And I finally said to Russell, he would call into the office and I would say, Russell, don't you have something for me to do? You want me to do? And he's like, no, I'll tell you when I have something. And finally I said, listen, why don't I just work out of your apartment? Right? And he was like, you do that? So I had what was then a portable computer. It was like this heavy thing that had to log out, right? Right. And I took it and put it in his dining area. And I changed his dining area into my office I put a big whiteboard up on the wall and had one column for Def Jam, one column for Rush Artist Management, one column for Rush Producers Management. And I had to explain to Russell that you have more than one company. You don't just have one company, and you can't just keep using the same books. You know, you can't use the same checkbook like this. So I was the person who actually helped him to see that he was broader than just this one label. But it was, you know, that was how it was at the time. You just did any, whatever came up, you did it.
But sure.
Def Jam was red, and Rush Artist Manager was black, and Rush Producers Manager was green. So, you know, the red, black, and green colors across the top, and was constantly just bringing little things from that I had brought with me from Grenada into this. And Russell would, you know, stay in his room until I would get there, I don't know, 10, 11, and he would still be in bed because he didn't get in till 4 or 5.
Right.
You know, I would just be working away, and he would come out, and he was just surprised to see all this stuff. He would hold meetings and you know, in there, and when he would make a commitment to somebody, I would then turn around and write it up, and he was surprised. He had never had somebody, like, you know, ghosting him.
Right.
In that way, and making clear that whatever he to follow through on whatever
right.
things he was doing.
He couldn't just say something one night and then
no,
to
right.
forget he said
right.
it. Yeah.
And he started, and I for a while I was actually traveling with him at night to, we went to Nell's an awful lot.
To hear more about NYC Nightclub Nell's, check out episode 188 with Stretch Armstrong and Evan Auerbach.
But it was the same thing. I would listen to what he was saying. He was just doing what he did, and then I would come back the next day and say, you know, what do we want to do with this and that, right? So it took a while, actually, for us to become close. But actually, I guess it wasn't a while. Just not in hindsight, it was short. But,
sure, well, if every day yeah. lasts from 10 in the morning till 5 in the morning, you know.
Yeah, so, you know, and I had been a party girl when I was in high school, right? But different music. I was a Motown era person, right? So... But I really loved music and always was, and as I said before, I was a big TV person, so this whole cultural thing, I loved it.
Yeah.
You know. But Russell, the thought that Russell did not work hard is wrong, right? And
yeah.
Russell, on the contrary, Russell is constantly working. But he had so much in his head and so much energy. He would come out of his room at like 1 o'clock in the afternoon, right? Get a bowl of chips of something, right? You know, and just sit down and start calling the DJs around the country, right? And
wow.
he would have a story for every single one, you know. Hi, Butterball. Remember when we did da 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 da? How such and such? Da 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 da. Bunch of curses. Bunch of women conversation. Then are you going to play my record? Da da da. Yes. Fine. Boom. Hang up. Call the next person. Right. No Rolodex. No notes. Right. All in his head. And he could do that for 4 hours at a clip, right? And it was not that people just loved the music that had gone on the air. No, Russell was pushing it. We had a staff, you know, a marketing staff, which grew as time went on.
Sure.
But and Bill Stephanie was the genius behind the marketing. I mean, there's no question, right?
Stephanie was our guest on episode 195.
But it was Russell who, if the DJs were not playing it, or the DJ, and the DJs had to respond to their program managers who were against hip-hop. So how to get them, you know, bucked up to take the risk was something that Russell did, right? And Russell did it relentlessly. And I'm talking about every 3 weeks. You know, the records came out on Tuesday, and there was Russell sitting down pushing these people to do this work. And his work ethic, he is phenomenal. You know, seeing him, you know, don't let the genes fool you, right?
Yeah.
You know, he's serious about it. Right?
Absolutely. And I wanted to get into your first foray into the crossover between music and movies, Tougher Than Leather, the film. What was that like?
Okay, so Tougher Than Leather had been made before I got there.
Okay.
Right? So I was only there for the premiere, right? There's a character in the movie called Carmen. And before I was Nana, my name was Carmen, right?
After taping the episode, we followed up with Nana about her name change, and this is what she told us. Quote, I'd been given the name Nana in 1973. It's an African from Ghana name. It means mother of the earth. It's also an honorific name for both men and women of a certain age, something like sir or ma'am. So I've been called Nana by some people since then. When I turned 60, I decided to use it as my name for everybody. Turning 60 was a big deal, and renaming myself was part of my overall decision to reset my life for the final third, and look at it as a new life of my own choosing rather than the end of life as I knew it. Self-empowerment for the middle age.
When I was working with Def Jam, I was Carmen Asher. And so people thought it was me, but it was not me. They didn't even know me. Right. And Blair Underwood was played Russell, of right. all things. Right. When it came out, and we had this big... Now, meanwhile, let me just back up a bit, that my film had come out, mm-hmm. 5 years before, 3 years before, Grenade of the Future Coming Towards Us, right? That was my idea of a movie, right? It was mm-hmm. a documentary that was telling you something that you needed to know in your life, right? Yeah. Tougher Than a Letter was not that. Right? And I was, it was still when I was back in this serious? I don't understand how this can be serious music. And mm-hmm. The film was not a big hit, but it really did make it that people recognized not just Run DMC, but that that artists had star power and star potential. And I think that was a turning point in the music. But our first foray into other than music was in television, mm-hmm. not in film. The first thing we did was a show called New Music Report with Search, MC Search, and Dougie Doug as our hosts, right? And then Dougie Doug did a lot of comedy sketches as part of this show. It was like a video music box. We would play a lot of music, and then they were in between. Dougie would do these things, right? And Search was the MC, right? But it was through Dougie Doug and seeing the reaction that he got, and we were in 80 cities. 80 markets, I'm sorry, with that show, right? Seeing the reaction that we got from Dougie Doug led Russell to think that comedy was something else we should be engaged with.
Right.
Right. And now my assistant at the time was a guy named Bob Sumner, who I knew through... There was another period of time when I was managing a jazz artist, right?
And, oh, wow.
Yeah, so Bob had a room that had jazz on several nights, but then he had another room that was comedy called the Peppermint Lounge, the Peppermint in Jersey, right? So I said to Russell that we didn't have to go very far. You already have an expert on black comedy right here. Talk to Bob. And Bob found all of these artists. It was Bob who became the person who set up our tour, to find comedians throughout the country. And then we went to HBO. Russell partnered with a guy named Stan Lathan.
Stan Lathan got his start in television working for the famous Boston Public Television station, WGBH, in 1968 when he was hired to create and direct the country's first magazine show entirely produced by, for, and about African Americans, Say Brother. He moved on to network TV and directed episodes of shows like Sanford and Son, Hill Street Blues, Miami Vice, Cagney and Lacey, and Rock. Lathan also directed the pilots for many sitcoms, including Martin, Moesha, The Parkers, The Steve Harvey Show, Amen, South Central, Cedric the Entertainer Presents, All of Us, Eve, The Soul Man, and Real Husbands of Hollywood. Additionally, he also directed the 1984 film Beach Street. He kept working for public TV and PBS as well, doing things as diverse as Great Performances, American Playhouse, various ballet and modern dance specials, and even was one of the first directors of Sesame Street. As Nana says, he and Russell partnered in 1989 to start Russell Simmons' Def Comedy Jam, which started a long partnership. In 2006, they created the reality show Run's House, which led to the spinoff Daddy's Girls, among the many other award-winning projects the two have done together. Lathan also created and executive-produced Brave New Voices, a 2008 docu-reality series for HBO, which led to a 2009 follow-up, an evening of poetry, music, and spoken word, hosted by President Barack Obama and Michelle Obama in the White House. Oh, and as for right now, he is executive producer and director of BET's Real Husbands of Hollywood and the executive producer and director of Dave Chappelle's comedy specials The Age of Spin and Deep in the Heart of Texas, which were released on March 21st, 2017 for streaming on Netflix.
And we produced the Russell Simmons Def Comedy Jam. Another example of Russell's thinking. It is not called the Def Comedy Jam. The show's name is the Russell Simmons Def Comedy Jam. He was branding before branding was a name.
Right. One of your big jobs was to help Russell Simmons find an identity, find a brand post Rick Rubin.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. I wouldn't say it was designed like that. It just became that. And Rick was a real prick, pardon me, but right, just, oh my God, he wanted to leave, but he was still making it difficult anyway, right? Mm-hmm. Other people have different feelings about Rick because they know him as a producer and love him,
Sure.
You ask LL Cool J about Rick and it's just, he's here's God and then here's Rick, right? You know, right? I don't have that feeling because I know him from the business side and he was a jerk, you know, and he kept Russell dangling on a string for years. It was awful, right? But anyway, aside from that, I was still amazed that this was happening under Black leadership. And so there was a magazine called BRE, Black Radio Exclusive, right? And Russell pitched to them a story on the women of Def Jam. By now, I was the vice president at that time. Chrissy, I had hired Chrissy Murray to do A&R. Faith had already been there.
Episode 191, guest Faith Newman.
Faith was A&R. I'm sorry. Chrissy was artist development. And I had hired another guy who, I can't even remember his name. That's terrible. Anyway, to help with the production. And Stephanie had hired Wes Johnson, Wes Party Johnson, to do marketing. Right? Mm-hmm. So we had this label. But what happened was when Rick was leaving, Russell was changing his relationship with Columbia, right? At the time with Columbia, right? Yeah. And but Columbia said that the difficulty they had was that Def Jam didn't have any structure. It didn't match what they were doing. They didn't know what to do. So I was the person who did create these pockets, you know, these departments are actually departments to match the departments that were at Columbia, right? So that their person had a point person for everybody, right? Before this, I mean, Faith was not just doing A&R. Faith was doing A&R and touring and, you know, writing sometimes, you know, like and handling the artists. It wasn't, you know, it was not prescribed like that, right? Yeah. In fact, I don't even think Chrissy was with us. We hired Chrissy as a part in that process of doing that. But the other part of it, so one part was creating a structure, just an organizational structure, which is how I became vice president of operations, right? But the other part was that I was just still into this, that this was a Black-led company, right? And so I talked about that in this article. And when it came out, Russell called me and was like, I couldn't believe what you said in your interview. I was like, yeah, but I really believe it. And I believe that he had a greater vision than people were giving him credit for, and that it was going to have a broader range that it was getting for. He said, one of the things that we discussed I said that he needed to create a parent company for these three different things. Mm-hmm. He created Rush Communications. His nickname is Rush, right? Yeah. So it's named after him, right? And he took that and, you know, spun it way further than I would have thought to do, right? Russell was happy to have a definition of the company and of the music that was bigger than we're a fad and we're going to make some records quickly. He was subsequently added fashion, which was Fat Fashions. Subsequently, but you know, the first was just the all music and entertainment. And so the television company became part of Rush Communications.
And around maybe 1990 or so, you actually move into the presidency of Def Jam.
Yeah. Now that's another one in retrospect. So I started in 88 as an assistant publicist, and by 1990, I was the president.
Yeah.
You know, when I look back on it, I was like, how did that happen that quickly? Right. You know, from working in this guy's living room to doing that. So Russell was very supportive of me. Now, Russell, though, is still, and to this day, kind of cheap, right? When it comes to salaries, right? You know? Yeah. So I was never the best paid person in the industry, right? Mm-hmm. But I was getting to work with the premier acts and the premier mogul.
Yeah. You were president at this very odd time, you know, 1991, where
the music business tanked.
Well, there was that, but there was also... But what I was going to say was hip hop was being brought into the mainstream in this kind of very aggressive way that hadn't really, you could sort of see the seeds of it before. But I feel like even those few years is kind of when it exploded. What was that like for you to be at the head of a record label, specifically hip hop record label that was in the middle of this maelstrom?
Keep in mind that the music business was tanking, right? Okay, so to have platinum acts at that time was extraordinary. Okay, they was just, that wasn't happening throughout the music business, right? And prior to our acts, you know, the big acts were Prince and Michael Jackson. And, you know, that was Black male masculinity was looking like that. LL Cool J does not look like that, right? You know, and it was never going to look like that, right? It was changing what the definition of who we were visually as well as what the sound was, right? That was, we had Public Enemy came out with Takes a Nation of Millions.
Bring the noise!
LL Cool J, Panther.
I'm the type of guy that comes when you leave. I'm doing your girlfriend. That's something you can't believe. Cause I'm the type of guy.
Slick Rick, The Great Adventures of Slick Rick. I mean, we were like killing them, right? You know, with albums that are classics to this day, right? We were managing Eric B. and Rakim.
Yeah.
Extraordinary. EPMD was on our management company.
Due to the fact they whack in their track, have to go back and stack because they lack the ingredients. EPMD.
And Jazzy Jeff from the Fresh Prince.
Once killed a man because he would not let go of his ego. Apollo Creed is a sucker. Charlie Mack could be Drago. He could bench about 300 pounds. The cops all take a vacation when Charlie's in town. He's the toughest around, so everywhere that I go, he goes. He's Charlie Mack and he's the first out the limo.
So damn wow.
Yeah.
So it was an extraordinary roster at a time when other people were struggling to have their acts who had been big guys, you know, all along have some standing, right? We had controversy, though. Luke Skywalker came out and, you know, and there was a big, the Senate tried to had hearings about it to put label. We had that. That's when parental advisory labels came on, which Russell loved. He was like, this is the best marketing ever, right? Every kid in America is going to want to buy that record that has parental advisory on it.
Right.
He's a genius on marketing, I just have to say. I mean, you know, and it is true that my friend Rick, right, Rubin, is a genius as a producer.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean you have to like it.
No, yeah. But he could not sell that music the way Russell sold that music. I mean, they were a powerful combination.
Bill was very involved in the Luke Campbell situation.
To hear more about Luther Campbell and Two Live Crew's battle with government censorship in the late 1980s and early 90s, listen to our interview with Campbell on episode 116. Bill Adler, then at Def Jam, was one of Campbell's foremost supporters in the music industry. We'll have a link in the show notes for this episode to a press release Adler wrote announcing a rally in support of the group.
Luke's concerts are for adults.
If it's an adult show, you have to be 18.
Luke's concerts are for adults.
Yeah, so we had a big press conference, right, and I think I was vice president at the time, but I had to come out and speak about it. And
how'd you feel about that?
I said, you know, like, I do not like the images of these women. Luke Skywalker gave us the lovely term video ho. He made that up. Right. And I'm like, I don't love this. I don't like it. It is against how I believe women should be described. Mm-hmm. But I do not think the government needs to be making these decisions, and I think that this is a threat, right? Mm-hmm. And Russell was at first was like, you know, like, no, you have to say you love him. I'm like, nah. But Bill said no, and by the end, both Bill and Russell liked that I had a different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
When we went before the Congress, though, I did not speak, though I was there, but that's where we met Michael Eric Dyson, who did testify.
Right.
Michael Eric Dyson, at that time a young professor at Brown University, got a standing ovation during his testimony in the 1994 hearings about gangster rap when he referred to C. Dolores Tucker and other black anti-rap activists as, quote, petty bourgeois Negro intellectuals. He went on to criticize them for coming down hard on obscenity and art while ignoring the conditions that produced it.
Dolores Tucker, you's a motherfucker. Instead of trying to help a nigga, you destroy your brother. Worse than the others, Bill Clinton, Mr. Bob Dole.
Right. That was a couple of years after Luke, though.
Yeah. While you were the president of Def Jam and then immediately afterwards, you know, mm-hmm. in addition to hip hop being mainstream, there was a movement towards, I don't particularly like the term, but for lack of a better term, mm-hmm. Gangster rap.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, the first gangster rap, the first big gangster rap, obviously, was N.W.A.
Right, right. Who you saw when you started back in, you know, 87, 88.
88, right.
Yeah.
And Fuck the Police was their hit ditty. Right. So even though it was, I mean, it was certainly gangster rap, you know? I mean, it was just, I'm the type of nigga that was built to last. Fuck with me, I'm gonna put my foot in your ass, okay?
Life ain't nothing but bitches and money, cause I'm the type of nigga that's built to last. If you fuck with me, I'll put my foot in your ass. See, I don't give a fuck cause I...
Not very light, you know, high, lively, easy conversation, right? But they put it in, and it was able to be at least simpatico with Public Enemy, right? It was against the police because of the police, the way the police treated Black people and Black kids in the community, and how, you know, so there was a part of it that you could get a sense of some political engagement around it. Stuff that came out afterwards didn't even attempt to do that. In fact, when I saw Straight Outta Compton, it was like they actually even made it even more so have a social commentary vibe to
it. Looking back on it,
yes,
they
right.
made that a little, maybe a little heavier than it was in real life.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But after that, it was just, you know, like how to kill people, how, you know, what's your guns, what's your, how much money, how many women. I mean, it became, you know, this vile thing. And I do not think that it is an accident that all of that happened when the majors took over our labels. Mm-hmm. Okay? I really believe that, and it's clear when you see it, you know, it's there's literally almost a line, you know, between from the time that the artists were talking about dancing and partying and whatever, right, mm-hmm. as well as political commentary, social commentary. And that was the time that Chuck D said that hip-hop was the CNN for Black people, right? Mm-hmm. Right. So it was a gangster rap was not any of that, didn't even pretend mm-hmm. to be any of that. It was just, you know, sales. You know.
Did you have acts on your label who you kind of felt not so great about?
Oh, bitches with problems.
Well, I'm something wrong. Buford was only 3 inches long. Now I'm pissed and I'm ready to bitch. But my cunt's so horny, I don't give a shit. Cause I'm one nasty ass bitch. And I need something up in my clip. I only got a hip and yes, I'm still sick. But what the hell, Buford, go for it. I'm through. Is this all I get? Is this supposed to be good dick?
Yes, we did have Bitches with Problems was on our label. The Boss. We had had a female rapper before, Nikki D.
Oh, I wanted to actually ask about her because mm-hmm. you said she kind of came in not necessarily gangster, but
right.
because it was sort of the time.
She took it on.
Yeah.
Right. Which I was disappointed with. Right. Russell was not. Russell wanted to really push her in that way. And Daddy's Little Girl did become, in fact, a hit at the time.
In my mind, I was a mature chap, but I couldn't hurt Daddy. I played the role, but on a sweet tip, I was a sergeant of soul. Nikki had to be free. You see, I had to be me. Her life just wouldn't flow through correctly.
So you had obviously these mixed feelings about even some of the groups on your own label who you were putting out.
I did. At the same time, though, we had of the seven officers, you know, of the company, mm-hmm. VP, the business manager, A&R, artist development, publicity, president, vice president, marketing, right? Mm-hmm. Five were women and four of those were Black. So I had the capacity to hire Black people into this business who would not have been able to get into it any other way, right? You know, Rhonda Cowan is now a star, and I mean, not a, you know, commercial star, but, you know, as a producer.
I believe in money, power, and respect. First you get the money, then you get the motherfucking power. After you get the fucking power, motherfuckers rule respect.
After a long career in the music business at Def Jam, Bad Boy, Motown, and BET, Rhonda Cowan is now in television, most recently as a co-executive producer on the series Money, Power, Respect.
But she would not have been hired by anybody other than Def Jam. We were able to be the training ground for some people who have gone on to have impact in the industry far beyond where we are. And I didn't take that power lightly. I took it as that was supposed to be my responsibility. The only reason, you know, the main reason I'm supposed to be running something is so that I can bring other people in behind me. So I wasn't going to quit behind Bitches with Problems. I did go on, what was that? It wasn't Maury Povich, but one of those kind of shows, right? With the woman from Bitches with Problems. And the interviewer got so vile with it that I ended up walking off the show.
It was actually a June 1991 episode of Donahue, which featured BWP, MC Light, Yo-Yo, and Harmony.
You talk about guys' two-minute brother, bitches. I call you bitches, you know, as a...
as
Bitches as a strong, positive, aggressive woman who goes after what she wants. And in that sense, she'll be called the bitch. So usually we take that on.
I see. I understand. And I think I understand this. You're not, you know, oh, Harry, will you take me out tonight? You're not.
I could not. And I was usually very protective of my artists, but I couldn't do it then. Even when I would accept awards for, you know, when we got a Black Music Award or whatever, whenever I would take an artist with me, right? Because I was clear that they were the ones who were key to us making the money, right? You know, right. So even though producers usually, you know, go up and do the accepting, I didn't find that appropriate. Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about, you know, I guess Lior had been Russell's number two, mm-hmm. right? And then here you are in a position of running the label and acting somewhat as Russell's number two and having this mm-hmm. long-running relationship with mm-hmm. him. Was there tension between you and Lior, and how did that play out?
There was tension. Lior is a very powerful presence, you know, so it's not like I was going to just jump up and have a fight with Lior. I mean, even an argument. No, I wasn't going to do all that, right? Mm-hmm. right. But Lior and I respect one another, but Lior felt like I was leading Russell in a direction with which he was not comfortable. I would say that the Black consciousness part of things, Lior did not see a purpose for that, mm-hmm. right? He was very active on the behalf of his artists, so he felt that that was how he was doing right by them. I felt like that was just, that's the job, right? That's like, yeah. that's not special, right? Yeah. right, you know? But to make it clear that they were a political and social and cultural force was a different kind of conversation. And Russell was comfortable having that kind of conversation and vision. Lior was not. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up, so there was a point when I had to make a choice. Was I going to, because the company split. We ended up with PolyGram. Lior became a force within the music business in his own right, right? Mm-hmm. And created a whole separate entity for Def Jam. And I took over Rush Communications because at that point I had to make a choice. Was I going to go with Lior or was I going to go with Russell?
Right? I was going to ask about that. That's how that ended up happening, that you mm-hmm. moved from the label to the overarching business.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's sort of. I mean, I wasn't particularly pleased with how it happened, but I took advantage of it. I was pregnant, right? And right. and then I gave birth. And while I was on maternity leave, I had appointed David Harlson, who was the vice president of business affairs at the time, as the interim president until I returned, right? And when I returned, Lior had convinced Russell that David should continue on as president. And Russell and I had a blowout, right? And so he said, but you already have I have something bigger for you. You have a better than a job. And I was like, I had a job. You know, like, what are you trying to tell me?
Right.
Eventually, to appease me, okay, Russell said I could be president of Rush Communications. And then I, in turn, took that and got us another office. And so Rush Communications moved over to Greenwich, to Greenwich Street. And Lior and Def Jam moved over to Varick Street, and Russell stayed on Broadway.
Mm-hmm. So you were all downtown, but in different places.
Yeah. But when I first started at Def Jam, we were in one building, 298 Elizabeth Street.
Heard a lot about that building.
I'm sure, yeah. right? And there were 9 employees. And by the time I left, there were 5 offices, 3 in New York, 1 in California, and 1 in London, and 141 people.
Wow. In a more general sense, you have talked before about women in the music industry being a lot in, you know, what you called the keep the artist happy areas mm-hmm. in publicity, artist development, marketing, stuff like that. And I have in my travels around the business even heard PR referred to as the pink ghetto. Mm-hmm. Can you break down for me why that happens?
Well, there's a philosophical and then there's a practical.
Right.
Practically, I would say that the music business has a history of being a rough business. Way before, please do not believe that gangsterism came into the music business through hip-hop. It did not, right? Gangsters were there way before hip-hop, right? You know, any conversation about Frank Sinatra lets you know. So, and there was, and the touring in particular was without question a way to launder money. So the people who were running the music business in the beginning were rough customers, right? And they you know, as all rough customer men do, right? Right. Hired people that they knew and hired people with whom they could throw down. They were there was not a place for women in that kind of culture, right? Except as an artist. That to me is how it transpired. But there was also, even in hip hop, it was very rough. What you do in promotion is not always a very pretty thing. Mm-hmm. Well, no. Let me change that, right? Because pretty is my word, right? That's not it. But it's, yes, you know, are doing regular stuff of giving them albums and so on. But, you know, you can also be taking them out to meet women. You can also be flying them around the country. Mm-hmm. You can be hooking them up with their girl for the night. It's a different kind of world in that kind of world that was just not comfortable for women. Right? At one point, when I found out that the promotion people were making more than I, even though I was president of the company, I asked, how could that be? Right? Mm-hmm. And Lior actually said to me, well, would you... If I asked you to go get a woman for this artist for the night, would you do it? And I said, no. And he said, that's why. Uh-huh. Right. So it wasn't like it was something like to be thought, you know, implied. It wasn't an implicit thing.
It was open at all levels of the company that this was going on.
But at the same time, the major labels required you to have videos, you know, required you to have, you know, a marketing plan, required you to have your artists go out. And those jobs did not require that kind of hardcore business, you know, stand. And women are able. I mean, it's just true. You know, there's a patience that was much more prevalent for women than for men.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Getting back to you for a minute, I wanted to delve into one thing about the movie business, which was your work on addiction.
The shocking new film from Abel Ferrara. Lily Taylor. Christopher Walken, Annabella Sciorra.
You want to know what's going to happen? Just wait and see.
The Addiction. Coming this fall.
Wow, you did some serious research.
So, is it...
Okay!
First of all, is it true that that movie only happened because Russell and Abel Ferrara went out for a few drinks together?
That's absolutely true. At the time... Yeah. No, I mean, a place called The Time, not...
Oh, at the time.
The Time Cafe.
Yeah.
Right, The Time Cafe. Yeah. And then subsequently at Nell's, once again, right? Yes. And Abel was... I mean, this is my observation, but Abel was fascinated by Russell. You know, he just could, you know, like he was sitting in Time, you know, cafe, and it was, you know, wherever Russell sits becomes Russell's office, you know, and people know where he, you know, that like people knew that if you wanted to talk to Russell, Time Cafe between 12:30 and 3:30, he was going to be there and all sorts of stuff. And he always had a phone. Mm-hmm. Right. Once the mobile phones came in, we lost Russell. Right. You know. Right. We used to be able to find him at his home or at the office, but once he had a mobile phone, that was it. He was able to move around completely. But so yes, that's how Abel was one of those people who was at times saw this and just found this to be a fascinating thing.
That movie had such a crazy cast.
Yeah.
Annabelle Sciorra and Christopher Walken.
Yeah.
And Lily Taylor.
Yes, right. Lily Taylor, and from Onyx, Fredro. Yes, right. So, and that was pretty much getting Fredro into the film was Russell's first priority, right? And once he was in the film, Russell became engaged in the process of the filmmaking, and he liked that this film was off. You know, The Addiction was never going to be like a mainstream film, right?
Yeah.
But Abel is not a mainstream filmmaker, right? But it was going to be a hit on some level. We did not know it was going to become a cult classic, you know?
Yeah.
Right. Right. But I think it has. But yeah, I would say that it was the thing that where Russell got the bug. Right?
Yeah.
It was sort of like Russell loved Quentin Tarantino, Reservoir Dogs, right?
Mm-hmm.
He loved it. And so Abel was sort of like Reservoir Dogs light, you know, maybe, you know, something in there.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, felt like he was built for this.
Right.
You know.
I want to ask real quick kind of about Fat Farm, which you alluded to earlier, Fat Farm Baby Fat. What was your involvement in the clothing business and kind of how did you feel about it?
So whenever we started a company, and we started a bunch, right? But whenever we started a company, I was the president as it started, right? And then my job was to hire the first people and, you know, do the research to find out how to make it happen, right? So that was my first, you know, and we started Fat Farm as clothing line, but it was really a store, right? And it was on Prince Street in Manhattan, and it was literally designed to be like a farm at first. You know, it had hay and all that, you know? We did all that, right? Right? And then that turned out to be corny, right? So we got rid of that, right? And just kept Fat Farm as a name, right? But what was always good was Russell took control of the designing. Now, he was not a designer, and we hired a designer. I did, and I hired a designer and hired a production. Production in fashion is different from production, right? She had to know how to size stuff, how to find fabric, blah, 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 right? But I was never going to be the permanent president because I don't know anything about fashion. So we did eventually hire somebody who ran that. Right? Mm-hmm. But Russell was convinced that we could do the same styles that kids wanted to wear, but just up the quality. Right. And that since kids were already willing to pay extra to buy a Ralph Lauren thing, they'd be willing to buy a pair of jeans that, you know, fit them better, right?
For a similar price point.
For a similar price point, right?
Wow.
Shirts had to be Sea Island cotton, right? That was like the very first thing that Russell said. And that became like the standard for the rest of the line, right? Now, I was the person who trademarked the name Baby Fat, right? I trademarked it thinking we could go into children's clothes because I had just had a baby.
Right. Okay, free clothes to the baby.
But yeah, right. So Baby Fat made perfect sense to me, right? Russell became involved with this woman named Kimora, right? Kimora Lee at the time.
Yeah.
And as part of their relationship, she took over Baby Fat. And Russell was the one who decided that Baby Fat should not be for children, but should be for women. Mm-hmm. I was pissed. I'm like, you know, just like women are not babies. Why are we designing clothes? You know, it was just, I was wrong. That's all I could say. As history has proven, right? I was wrong that it was that the little cat, you know, all of that, you know, I was just like, how can this be? This was supposed to be a cute little thing on, you know, on a onesie. Mm-hmm. It was not, you know, women are not supposed to be wearing t-shirts that are so tight that you can't even fit. Well, I was wrong.
Right. Why did you leave the music business, entertainment industry more broadly?
Well, I didn't want to leave the entertainment business, right? Mm-hmm. But after a while, it got ugly. Some of the stuff that I was saying about marketing and so on was coming out of marketing and coming into my office because I was president of the company, right? So we had an incident with one of the artists, two of the artists, right, who wanted a check, right? You know, and I told them, no, you can't. You know, you're still, you know, you haven't recouped yet, and so it's not time to give you another check, right?
Yeah. Okay.
They called Russell and said, we want $30,000 because we want to buy a Jeep. Right? Russell said, well, what did Carmen say? And he said, she said no, right? They show up at the office at 298 Elizabeth Street with sawed-off shotguns, right? Right. And the security guy over there called me and told me, Carmen, they're looking for you. They're on the way up there. And they're actually on their way up to first to you and then to Russell. Right. So my son already had a bodyguard. All right. So there you go. That starts, you know, that's where life had become. My son, you know, and he was at daycare. Right. And so I sent his bodyguard to pick him up. But I said, don't bring him back to the office. Take him home. Right. Mm-hmm. And I'll meet you there. Right. And I said, because it's just not safe enough for him to be here. And then I realized if it's not safe for him, it's not safe for me.
For you, right? Yeah, right.
Prior to this, I had found that our bookkeeper for Fat Farm had been embezzling, right? And I reported it to the police. And instead of him just going off kindly, he had a contract put out on me, right? And so the police called our lawyer and told them that they had credible source that there was a contract out on Carmen Ashurst, and the threat was to Russell. You either don't put him in jail or we will kill Carmen. So I called Russell and I was like, Russell, you know, what are we going to do? And he said, oh, Carmen, people threaten my life all the time. Right. And I was like, that's not an answer. That's not a good answer. Right? Right. So I came back. I went and got my son and I was like, okay, until they catch this guy, I'm hiding out. And I took my son and we went to D.C. Now, I did not go to like a domestic violence shelter. I went to the Four Seasons. Right. Because right? Yeah, yeah. I was in the music business. Right. I still had that mindset, was still there. It was like, and we stayed there. I ended up calling a personal friend of mine who was an assistant DA in the Manhattan District Attorney's Office and asked him to make sure that they found the guy. And so they did send police traced him out to California. And it's pretty clear that had this friend of mine not been the ADA on the thing, they would not have sent police all the way across the country.
Sure.
But they did. And they brought him back and he did go to jail. But that happened. And then within months afterwards,
you had the thing with the artist that you talked about.
And so I decided I needed to leave. I left and I went to seminary.
Right.
And the person who actually helped me decide that I could, in fact, leave, even though I didn't know where I was going to land, was Joey, right? Who is now, you know him as Reverend Run, right?
Oh.
Right. Right. But yeah. Joey, I had called Joey when I was thinking about leaving and thinking about getting more engaged in the church. And
Seems like a reasonable person to call in that situation.
Yes, really, right?
In the music business for the church, right?
Yeah. And he took me with him to his church that one night, and we went to his minister was a bishop, and it was a remarkable Billy Preston was the musician, was the piano player. Wow. In his church, right? Yeah.
Billy Preston, sometimes called the Fifth Beatle, was a musician, songwriter, and performer who played as a session keyboardist with acts like Little Richard, Sam Cooke, and Ray Charles. He then became a platinum-selling solo artist in his own right and wrote Joe Cocker's You Are So Beautiful. He also remains the only person ever to play for both the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. Preston died in 2006.
Right.
That's all right.
Yeah,
that's
right. All right. Yeah. So it took me in a very different direction. And so Joey and I were of a similar mind around that. We had different theologies, but obviously that's not important in this particular conversation. Right.
Right.
Right. But he was very helpful to me thinking that my life would not be over as of it being interesting because I left. And obviously, Joey did not feel any problem about staying in the music business. I mean,
sure.
So we were on different philosophies, but he was helpful to me. And he was helpful in getting Russell to not be angry at me and not take it personally.
Mm-hmm. What is going on now? You are at Greater Centennial and you're at Children's Health Fund, I believe.
Yes.
And tell me.
I work for the Children's Health Fund, which mm-hmm. is we provide health care, free health care, to disadvantaged children around the country,
mm-hmm.
and also do advocacy work on behalf of children. So at this moment, with the Affordable Care Act under attack and the Children's Health CHIP program under attack, we are ramping up our advocacy work.
I can imagine. I'm sure CHIP didn't fare well in this last budget that they floated.
CHIP did, but it's probably the last time.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Right. And it got through, you know, the same way that these other, like, you know, CPB got through. Just like they had to do it by a certain date. You know? But when September or, you know, December comes, it's all, you know, the budget starts all over again. So.
Mm. Right. Okay. And what are you doing at Greater Centennial?
Greatest Centennial, I'm on the ministerial staff there, and mm-hmm. I work with primarily people who have suffered from depression. I'm a depressive, and I gave a sermon at one point a couple of years ago by now about depression and how it's not talked about very much in the church, but that it needs to be,
mm-hmm.
and it needs to be talked about in the Black community, that if you're Black and you're not depressed, that's a question, right? You know, so we really need to be understanding that mental health is an issue that we need to address. So that, I would say that's what I've been doing.
And finally,
of
course. yeah.
Something I do want to talk about is Black Lives Matter.
Of course. Right?
Because even though people's, you know, hip hop has now been just sort of trashed as, you know, is it all gangster rap? Is it all ugly? First of all, I do not think that anymore. I think that there's a real resurgence coming in hip hop. And you can really hear that the music and the subject matter and in both. I mean, the subject matter is, you know, more socially conscious, but also the music itself is more complex. It's no longer just scratching and whatnot. They are really using actual instruments and creating a bed of music. And it's much more musical and more high quality in its production as well as the lyrics. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the real, where we really see the impact of hip hop now is the Black Lives Matter movement. I do not believe that there would be a Black Lives Matter movement operating the way it does had it not been for hip hop. And if you ask them, they grew up on hip hop. You know, all of the people who are, who take a the forward stance in Ferguson, who take a forward stance in Baltimore, you know, come out of the hip hop community. And I do not, I want people to recognize the contributions that hip hop has made, not just to music, but to our social concept as well. It's given kids a sense that you do have a voice. It's given kids a sense that you do have a responsibility to raise that voice, and you deserve to get paid for your work, right? Which is something that hip hop brought to artists. Artists, you know, the concept of the the poor starving artist is, you know, one that has spread forever, but you know. No, you know, the hip hop guys were the ones who said, no, you have to pay me as the same as others in that. And I think that that is an important contribution. But I really want people to understand that this whole consciousness of Black youth, understanding that they had a broader context than just their neighborhood, while believing in their neighborhood, understanding they had a broader vision, comes out of hip hop. And I think that's an important contribution that shouldn't be ignored.
Of course. Well, that sounds like a great note to end on. Nana Ashurst, thank you so much for being a guest.
Thank you.
We talk to a lot of people from all different areas of hip-hop at The Cypher, but it's hearing from folks like Nana, who play an important roles in the music and culture, but whose contributions aren't as recognized as they should be, that really makes me glad to be bringing you the show. Without Nana, it's unlikely that we'd have Def Comedy Jam, and thus all the stars who came out of that show. Def Jam might never have grown to its current size and influence. And the face of hip-hop fashion would look very different if she hadn't helped Fat Farm and Baby Fat get off the ground. I hope you enjoyed hearing her story. Join us next week when our guest will be producer Ron Amon-Ra Lawrence. He's best known for his time as part of Bad Boy's production collective The Hitmen, and has produced classic songs for Biggie, Mace, Diddy, Jay-Z, LL, and more. We talked to him about all that. And, of course, about his underrated group, Two Kings in a Cypher, whose music opens every episode of this show. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cypher as soon as it comes out, subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app of choice. That's a great opportunity to check out our back catalog. If you like this episode, for instance, you should listen to our talk with another early Def Jam employee, Bill Stefney, on episode 195. Whatever you use to listen to the show, Apple's podcast app, Google Play, seriously, whatever. Go now and give us a rating and a review. It helps us bring more fans and attention to the show. And you can really help us by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. Bringing you the show takes at least 20 hours a week, and we could really use the support. If even 20% of you gave us just a buck a month, we could at least afford to eat while researching and editing. As an added bonus for our patrons, every month, we share bonus audio that we get from our guests, either while talking to them after the main interview is over, or sometimes when they give us some extra special material. Join by the end of June to have access to July's file. Previous months have included unreleased music from the likes of Wu-Tang and Chuck D. If you want to talk to us about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sataro.
You know, stuff hanging in his hair and torn jeans. He was white.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
But it was, in fact, a room, right, with a, you know, small camera.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
I hadn't voted for him.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
He wanted the white audience to cross over to us.
Our audio assistant is Rob Van Vranken.
And he said, oh, Carmen, people threaten my life all the time.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Josh Halzak.
That was horrible.
Extra special thanks to Bill Adler for his help in making this episode happen.
Witty conversation and political conversation.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Can you tell your godfather to give you a job? You know, like...